Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the succession this week in Saudi Arabia of a new crown prince, likely to be Prince Nayef, who is a hardliner close to the Wahhabi religious establishment. Saudi expert Gregory Gores joins us to discuss what influence the current interior minister will have on the political future of an absolute monarchy that finds itself increasingly isolated by the Arab Spring unfolding in the Middle East and increasingly drawn into a conflict with Iran following recent accusations that Iranian agents plan to assassinate the Saudi ambassador in Washington. Then we will discuss the departure of the U.S. ambassador to Syria, who has been pulled out because of threats from the Assad regime, who are unhappy with the ambassador's support for the Syrian opposition. Muraf Joujati, a Syrian-born expert on the Middle East who teaches at the National Defense University, joins us to assess the impact of this escalation between the U.S. and Syria and whether the downfall of Gaddafi will lead the Syrian opposition to take up arms. Then finally, we will discuss the mother of all corporate scandals outlined in a new book, Retirement Heist, How Companies Plunder and Profit from the Nest Eggs of American Workers. The author, former Wall Street Journal Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Ellen Schultz, joins us to explain the obvious brazen contempt the top 1% have for the bottom 99% who are being robbed of their pensions to enrich the already lavish retirements of overpaid CEOs. I'm now speaking with Gregory Gores, who is the department chair and professor of political science at the University of Vermont. He's the author of three books, The International Relations of the Persian Gulf, Oil Monarchies, Domestic and Security Challenges in the Arab Gulf States, and Saudi-Yemeni Relations, Domestic Structures and Foreign Influence. Previously, he was a fellow for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gregory Gores.
My pleasure.
And the likely secession of Crown Prince to the Crown Prince to replace the recently departed Crown Prince by Prince Nayef has already been met with some sense that, one, he is a hardliner, and two, he's close to the Wahhabi religious establishment, and I suppose the assumption there is that he will be, less of a so-called reformer than the current king?
Well, that's certainly the conventional wisdom, but I think that there are a couple of things we've got to recall about conventional wisdom on these things. One is that Saudi Arabia, as you mentioned, is an absolute monarchy, and thus court politics is where politics happens, and court gossip is the coin of the realm. The problem with court gossip, of course, is that 90% of it is wrong, and you don't know which 10% of it is right. So we have to be careful about that, because the people who actually know about what goes on within the inner circles of the ruling family don't talk about it, and the people who talk about what goes on in the inner circles of the ruling family pretty much universally don't know. So I'm going to try to prove that adage wrong by talking a little bit about it. But we have to take into account that a lot of what we hear is gossip, and 90% of it is wrong. The other thing I think we have to remember is that we in the West have a tendency to label these guys. He's the reformer. He's the hardliner. He's the Islamist. He's the liberal. And in fact, I think that those are convenient boxes we put these guys in. And to some extent, they do reflect roles they play. Because Nayef has been the chief of police for 35 years in Saudi Arabia. And the chief of police is always a hardliner, because that's his job. Who knows what will be his king? I mean, I'm old enough now that I remember that when Abdullah was crown prince, quite a few quote-unquote experts on Saudi Arabia in the West said he was conservative, tribal, and anti-American, and he's turned out not to be. So while Prince Nayef is certainly not somebody who's been known as an advocate of political reform, it'll be interesting to see what happens if he gets the top job.
Well, what we don't have to speculate on, Gregory Gores, is that this is something of a gerontocracy, right? It's a bit like watching the Kremlin.
Yeah, I mean, this is the model that usually gets that gets referenced when you talk about the Al-Saud these days, is that they could fall the way the last Soviet leaders, Brezhnev and you know, I don't even remember the names of the other guys that led to Gorbachev and then to the collapse of the Soviet Union. And the structures are the same. There's no question about it. You've got a bunch of old guys. The king is in his late 80s. Nayef is in his late 70s, if not 80. And the other brothers, because you still have a couple other members of that generation, are all in their 70s or 80s. So it could be a fairly quick set of successions. The big issue, though, I think for Saudi Arabia is what happens when they have to move the succession from this generation of brothers and half-brothers down to their sons, to what I would call the third generation, the grandsons of the founding king of modern Saudi Arabia, because that transition has no precedent, and it will privilege a couple of people and cut a lot of other people out, and thus it could be a very contentious time.
Again, I'm speaking with Gregory Gorsuch, the department chair and professor of political science at the University of Vermont. He's a specialist on Saudi Arabia, and we're talking about the succession, the likely succession of the interior minister, Prince Nayef, to become the crown prince. And this is in the context, of course, of the Saudis being an absolute monarchy in an area that where the sands are shifting in terms of the Arab Spring. There seems to be a universal demand on the part of young Arabs throughout this whole region, from Tunisia all the way to Yemen, demanding. One of the words that comes across is dignity. The notion that powerful and wealthy elites have stolen their future. Why should it be different in Saudi Arabia?
I think that the biggest reason it's different in Saudi Arabia now and probably in the near future is money. The Saudis are sitting on a pile of money that they were able to deploy earlier this year as the upheavals of Tunisia and Egypt and Bahrain and Yemen were commencing. Syria and Libya were a little down the line. The Saudi rulers basically committed to spending $130 billion over the next few years on their population. Some of that is immediate salary increases, bonuses to workers who are in the public sector, and the vast majority of Saudis who work for the government. And that, I think, played a big role in taming the calls for protests in Saudi Arabia. There was a call in, as I recall, in mid-February for a day of rage, for demonstrations in Saudi Arabia that would mimic the demonstrations in Tunisia and Egypt and Yemen and elsewhere and Bahrain, and it fizzled. Basically nothing happened. And I think that the money goes a long way to explaining that.
Well, it may also have been Prince Nayef and the 130,000 men in the security services that are under him, in particular the religious police, who are quite ubiquitous. And my understanding is that the young, even if they are not, they may be rebellious, they may not have wanted to take the kind of chances. And frankly, it's quite breathtaking to see the kind of courage displayed by young Syrians and young Libyans and others who faced tanks in these upheavals that we've seen.
Without a doubt, the security forces play a role. But that's not something that sets Saudi apart. As you said, the security forces are ubiquitous and nasty in these other places, too, in which we've had large-scale demonstrations. So that's not the ferocity of the security apparatus doesn't set Saudi apart.
Sure. But I was going to get, though, to the area that the portfolio that many analysts are suspicious of Nayef about, and that is his closeness to the Wahhabi religious establishment, since he, first of all, the House of Saud are the custodians of the holy shrines, and that gives them the religious legitimacy, which is reflected by the Wahhabis, that he, in effect, controls the religious police who enforce these strictures, which my understanding are very unpopular with the young and probably with the women too. I don't know what percentage, but, you know, we've had incidents of women trying to drive, etc.
Right. I think that the thing about Nayef's control, or let's say Nayef's, it's not control, Nayef's relationship with the religious establishment is that it is not inconsistent with the entire family. That is to say, it's not that he represents the religious point of view and other people don't. They all represent this relationship with the religious establishment. The popular perception in Saudi Arabia right now is that Nayef is more closely aligned with the religious types than Abdullah, particularly on issues like women's role in public life and things like that. But we should be careful because, you know, within the top levels of the family, they apportion out portfolios. You know, this prince takes care of this group. This prince takes care of this group. They even do that on foreign policy. This prince takes care of Syria. This prince takes care of Yemen. And it seems that Nayef is taking care of the religious types. But at the same time, Nayef has been publicly extremely critical on occasion of the religious establishment, the people who run the religious schools and the mosques. He said publicly on more than one occasion, you people aren't doing your job. You people aren't teaching the quote-unquote true Islam, because if you were, people wouldn't be rebelling. So I think it's a more complicated picture.
Well, how much has his foreign policy outlook evolved? Because after the September 11th attacks, Nayef supported the notion that this, you know, we have these truthers in this country that have these bizarre theories about Bush and Cheney organizing 9/11. But throughout the Middle East, there's been a lot of denial about the Saudi role, and particularly in Saudi Arabia, and these conspiracy theories blamed it all on a Jewish plot, which is what Prince Nayef did. I take it he's finally given up that notion.
Well, I think that the big turning point in terms of the Saudis was not 9/11. It was May 2003. Because in May 2003, Al-Qaeda, what we now call Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, began attacks within Saudi Arabia itself. And the first one was on a compound where foreigners, and not just Westerners, but also foreign Arabs, live in Riyadh. And once the attacks started in Riyadh and in Saudi Arabia, and they went beyond the compounds, there was actually a car bomb attack on Nayef's ministry, the Ministry of the Interior. He basically changed his tune. This is a guy who, just weeks before the 2003 attack, said there is no such thing as Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia, and then all of a sudden it was brought home to him very, very directly. So his ministry was caught flat-footed, and this was their job, was internal security. And he turned on a dime and basically took the fight to the Al-Qaeda guys in the streets. And for a couple of years, it was touch and go. But the security forces got on top of them by 2005, 2006. And right now, if you talk to people in Washington, they would say that their counterterrorism cooperation with the Saudi Ministry of the Interior is among the best that they have with any foreign actor.
Again, I'm speaking with Gregory Cause. Sorry, I'm speaking with Gregory Gause, the department chair and professor of political science at the University of Vermont. He was previously a fellow for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and is a specialist on Saudi Arabia. What influence do you think, Gregory Gause, this trial, Iranian used car salesman from Texas, who's supposedly involved with the IRGC in Iran in a plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador, who I believe is very, very close to the king in Washington, D.C., has been met with a lot of skepticism. I take it that the Saudis are are taking it seriously, and that there was more to the plot than, you know, at the time when it was announced by Eric Holder, the head of the FBI, referred to it as kind of a bizarre movie plot, which probably invited even more skepticism. But supposedly this plot was to coincide with the Hajj, with the pilgrims showing up in Mecca, and this there was going to be apparently a lot of pilgrims from Iran, and that the actual assassination was supposed to take place on the same to coincide with that. And the theory is that there was going to be some kind of rebellion within the holy cities. And I recall that the thing that really got the House of Saud upset was when a radical group did take over the holy shrines some time back. And that was was Al-Qaeda, was it not?
Well, I think that the reference to the 1979 takeover of the Grand Mosque by a guy named Juhayman al-Otaibi, who proclaimed himself, actually proclaimed one of his friends to be the Mahdi, the kind of the returned Messiah of Islam, really isn't Al-Qaeda. It was kind of a very kind of marginal millenarian movement. It happened mm-hmm. when the Islamic year turned to 1400.
I guess it was a pre-Al-Qaeda in as much as the response to it was to export all of jihadis to Afghanistan, right?
Right. Well, that, of course, the whole Afghanistan adventure was something that we and the Saudis were both extremely involved with in encouraging the development of the jihadist movement. But, the Juhayman incident in 79 is a precursor, but not a direct if you will, ideological predecessor of Al-Qaeda. But without a doubt, the Saudis are extremely sensitive about the management of the pilgrimage. And in fact, in the 80s, right after the Iranian Revolution, there were a number of incidents where the Iranian pilgrimage delegation, you know, engaged in demonstrations and things like that that the Saudis didn't like, and there was some violence. Since 1990, the pilgrimage has been extremely quiet, and the Iranians have not tried to exploit the pilgrimage to score political points against the Saudis. It would be really uncharacteristic of, you know, 20-some years now of Iranian policy, I think, to do that now. The details of this plot are, who knows, right? Who knows? I don't have any inside access to this information, and I want to hold my judgment on that until I learn more about it. It sounds weird and far-fetched, but I think in terms of the Iranian-Saudi relationship and the Iranian-Saudi rivalry, I don't think that this changes anything. The Iranians and the Saudis have been at each other for a number of years in Lebanon, in Palestine, in Iraq, in other places, in the Middle East, in Central Asia, in Pakistan, to try to, in this contest for influence within the region. And thus, you know, if somebody in the Revolutionary Guard in Iran thought, well, we can rub out the Saudi ambassador in Washington, maybe they led this schlub from Texas on. I don't know, but I don't think that that this incident, even though the Saudis are playing it up a lot, really fundamentally changes the dynamic between Saudi and Iran. I think the Saudis playing it up is an effort to convince the Americans that they should be even tougher on Iran.
Well, just in closing, Gregory Gores, what is the likely foreign policy relationship to be affected by the ascension of Prince Nayef? And I mean, clearly, the Saudi version of Wahhabism has, they have exported it, arguably Afghanistan, Pakistan has been influenced by Saudi religious foreign policy, if that's the way to describe it. And it's also been spread around the world, particularly to Africa. And, you know, it is a fairly austere, if not xenophobic, form of Islam. And I don't believe at the end of the day it's been particularly helpful to U.S. interests, particularly in Afghanistan and Pakistan. But we sort of turn the other cheek, if you will, because of the oil, don't we?
Yeah, and I think that it's a complicated history because, of course, in the 80s we were very happy to encourage the flow of Arab fighters into Afghanistan against the Soviet Union, and really, if we want to trace the origins of Al Qaeda, they begin there. And so, both we and the Saudis, I think, what can we say, short-sighted about that. And without a doubt, the Saudis, the version of Islam that the Saudis have at home and that they propagate abroad is xenophobic and highly scriptural and very retrograde in many senses. There's no question about that. The ascension of Nayef to the role of crown prince, the likely ascension of Nayef and perhaps then to king afterwards, I don't think will have that much effect on the relations between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. I think that Nayef is somebody who, since 2003, has fought against al-Qaeda at home and abroad in Yemen and other places. On that score, he'll be on the same page with the U.S. He won't be on the same page with the U.S. regarding domestic political reform, but we don't really push domestic political reform in Saudi Arabia for the reasons you said, the importance of oil, the importance of the strategic relationship. And any Saudi king deals from a perspective of consensus within his family, which for decades has called for and relied upon a strong relationship with the United States that paid off for them in 1990 when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. So I don't see a big change with Nayef, frankly. I think that if 9/11 didn't change the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia fundamentally, I don't think having Nayef being crown prince or king is going to change it.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Gregory Gause.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Gregory Gause, the department chair and professor of political science at the University of Vermont. He's the author of three books, The International Relations of the Persian Gulf, Oil Monarchies, Domestic and Security Challenges in the Arab Gulf States, and Saudi-Yemeni Relations, Domestic Structures and Foreign Influence. Previously, he was a fellow for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Muraf Joujati, who is a Syrian-born specialist on Middle East affairs, and in particular, Syrian politics. He is currently a professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. Muraf Joujati also served as the National Program Officer in Syria for the United Nations Development Program and as an advisor to the Syrian delegation to the Middle East peace talks. Welcome to Background Briefing, Muraf Joujati.
Thank you very much.
And just in terms of what's just happened, in two things have just happened in terms of, we've spoken before about the really hideous situation in Syria where ordinary citizens are braving and risking their lives, facing this brutal regime that's murdering them callously. There doesn't seem to be a lot that the world community is doing and has done. But a couple of things have just happened. One is that Gaddafi has fallen, and that's got to make the Assads feel a little insecure. And two, the U.S. ambassador has just been withdrawn because I believe the U.S. government felt that his security could not be guaranteed by the Assad regime, who are unhappy with the fact that the U.S. ambassador is meeting with the opposition.
That's exactly right. On the first point, the Assad regime, Assad in particular, are terrified, of course. What happened to Gaddafi may happen to Bashar al-Assad. The killing of Gaddafi has certainly emboldened the opposition, who, as you said, is very resilient. The opposition movement now is in its eighth month, with civilians being killed every day by a fantastically brutal regime. The U.S. ambassador had to leave, actually, because the Assad regime is inciting its supporters through the media, through newspapers, against Ambassador Ford. Now, in Syria, there is no initiative that can be taken without the prior approval of the security services. And so, in the past, in the very recent past, whereby Assad supporters have pelted the U.S. embassy with eggs and tomatoes and what have you, this was done, of course, with the acknowledgement, if not the encouragement, of the security services in the Assad regime. Now the Assad regime has taken it a notch further and is writing articles about Ambassador Ford to incite further disturbances against the U.S. embassy and against the U.S. ambassador. And it's against this background, I think, that the State Department has recalled him.
Well, it's quite ironic to think that this ambassador's appointment was held up by a Senate hold by Senator Coburn for the longest time. Apparently, Senator Coburn relented. It was never quite clear why he disapproved, but you know, a lot of ambassadors are being held up in the U.S. Senate, as is, of course, a lot of legislation. So it's a bit ironic, don't you think, that this very courageous man has not had the full support of his own government?
Well, he didn't have it at first, I understand, because some senators were fearful that sending a U.S. ambassador to Syria would bring the wrong message to the Assad regime, that it would legitimize somehow the Assad regime. Well, Ambassador Ford was in Damascus, and he was extremely brave and creative and met with opposition leaders. He went to towns that the Syrian regime would have liked him not to go to because he was able to see firsthand the brutality of the Assad regime. And so as a result, really, of exposing the Assad regime, these senators that had opposed him going to Damascus then were on board, again, given the extremely valuable job that he had done.
So Muraf Zhujadi, again, Syrian-born specialist on Middle East affairs, particularly on Syrian politics. The suggestion is that the grim pictures of the end of Gaddafi, which was almost, like it took us back to the days of the Roman Colosseums, where, you know, he's almost torn apart by a pack of dogs, if you will. But very, very disturbing imagery. Why do you think that gets under the Assad skin? I mean, I think the answer is obvious, but I'd like to get your explanation.
Well, look, he is very obstinate. He wants to remain in power. He is of the view that Syria is his family farm. He will tolerate no dissent. If there is any dissent, he will simply crush it. And so he saw his equal, really, in Libya, equally obstinate, who would not go, who would not tolerate any dissent, promised to kill any dissenter, and that was his destiny, Muammar Gaddafi. His obstinacy did not pay off. He was caught by revolutionaries, and he was obviously very badly mistreated to the point of death. So there is a parallel here. It shows that Bashar al-Assad could be or is vulnerable to the same kind of treatment if he is going to continue being that obstinate.
So what specifically is happening, Murat Shujadi, to remove him? I mean, my sense is the last time I spoke, and fairly recently, with a Syrian opposition figure, it was pretty clear to me that his feeling was that this is a regime you cannot deal with, that they have no serious intention to reform, and that they will not still stop killing people until they've literally killed everybody who opposes them or who dare oppose them, and that inevitably the opposition would have to take up arms. So where do we stand?
Well, the level of violence has increased. The number of civilians that have been killed has increased. The numbers of detainees has increased very dramatically. People need to defend themselves. And as a result of that need, that urgent need, there is now a great black market for weapons. Weapons that are coming through from Lebanon, from Iraq, and are sold on the black market in Syria. Families are beginning to arm themselves again in order to defend themselves. But in addition, there are a lot of defections from the army. And now the more defections there are, the more militarized this revolution is going to become, which, if it continues, may lead to civil war. But of course, the brutality, the increasing brutality of the Assad regime is galvanizing the international community, which, although it is not doing nearly enough, has begun to mobilize itself to see what kind of approach, what kind of an approach it should have against this murderous regime.
So what is happening in Turkey? Is there some kind of safe haven being formed there? And I understand that in the Anwar province of Iraq that borders on the west of Syria, borders on the east of Syria, that there is a lot of arms coming through. You mentioned Lebanon as well. What's happening in terms of Turkey?
Well, there are thousands of Syrian refugees inside Turkish territory now. There are Syrian refugees, but in lesser number, that are moving to Lebanon. Turkey, of course, which was a great friend of the Assad regime until recently, has lost patience, has given up, does not want to see more refugees coming in, and yet, of course, cannot deny them entry because they would be murdered by the Assad regime. And so Turkey, I think, has washed its hands off of this this regime, and its tone is becoming more and more critical of the Assad regime.
And in terms of sanctions by the Europeans and by the U.S., particularly oil revenues have been cut. There was indications that there was some displeasure in the kind of merchant class who have been essentially bought off by the regime. The regime itself staged massive demonstrations in Damascus. So how much are we to believe of that the support for this regime is anything but patronage and fear?
We should not believe very much. Those who we are shown as supporters are civil servants whose salaries would be cut if they do not go down to the street and chant slogans of support. There are school children that are forced out of their schools onto the streets. So these are truly not genuine demonstrations of support. Even in the merchant class, there are many who are beginning to be seriously alienated. There is no money going into Syria. The trade is down dramatically. Many shops and many businesses have gone bankrupt, and others are going bankrupt and are laying off their workers, which is multiplying an already high rate of unemployment. And so the economy is truly not doing well at all, given sanctions on oil, which have denied the Assad regime 30% of government revenues. Obviously, there is no tourism. That's another 30% of revenue. And so revenue is shrinking constantly, and tensions are rising on a daily basis.
So does this mean their days are numbered?
I believe the Assad regime is going to collapse. I cannot give you a date certain. I cannot tell you how it is going to collapse, but there is simply no going back to business as usual. Society, Syrian society, will simply not tolerate a regime that has so much blood on its hands and that is that doesn't hesitate to continue killing its own citizenry.
My understanding from Iranian specialists I spoke with, they were arguing that that Iran thinks that Syria is going to prevail, that the Assads are going to prevail. I noticed that Iran was even critical of the Assads' brutality.
That's correct. Imagine if even Iran is critical of Assad's brutality, then you get a sense of the type of brutality that is being used. Even Iran has somewhat changed its tone regarding the Assad regime and is imploring Assad to put in some urgent but significant reforms. Thus far, the Assad regime could only come up with very cosmetic reforms, the kinds that would maintain the hegemony of the regime over its society.
So do you think then that given the in the broader Middle East, there's this rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran, which is coming to a head now with this alleged plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador in Washington, do you think that in effect Saudi Arabia wants the Assads to fall and will do what they can to help that, and conversely Iran doesn't want the Assads to fall and will do what they can to help them?
Well, you know, this is precisely what is happening, and already the Saudi monarch some time ago has withdrawn his ambassador to Damascus, and Saudi Arabia very recently was supportive of an Arab League motion to send a committee, a ministerial committee, to Damascus, which in fact is going to arrive in Damascus after tomorrow, Wednesday. So the Saudis are increasing their support for the opposition movement. On the other hand, Iran has very high stakes in Syria and wishes the Assad regime to continue dominating so that Iran can, through Syria, have a reach into the Arab-Israeli conflict.
So, is it... I mean, it's a competition between surrogates, I guess, on the outside, and this completely lopsided competition inside, where you have the Assad regime and its thugs, and most of whom are organized around the Alawite minority. Again, I guess at the end of the day, just in closing, the real Achilles heel is whether the army breaks, and it sounds like there've been some defections.
You're absolutely right. There is a battle for Syria at the regional level. At the domestic level, it's a very uneven battle. Though having said that, history is on the side of a civilian, peaceful uprising that demands freedom against a dictatorial regime that has been in power for 41 years. and that has instituted martial law for 48 years. We are talking about half a century of martial law. So it is inevitable that the regime collapse. It is simply a question of when and how.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Murat Shujati.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Murat Shujati, who is a Syrian-born specialist on Middle East affairs, particularly Syrian politics. He is currently Professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies, and he's also served as the National Program Officer in Syria for the United Nations Development Program and is an advisor to the Syrian delegation and as an advisor to the Syrian delegation to the Middle East peace talks. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about retirement heist.
The rent book tension. A little birdie told me you've been sizing the poor box. I heard the knitting circle discussing chub locks. What's all the commotion? What do they expect? No sign of a promotion. I lost my self-respect, you see.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ellen Schultz, an investigative reporter who has covered the retirement crisis for more than a decade. Formerly with the Wall Street Journal, her reporting has led to congressional hearings, proposed legislation, and investigations by the Treasury and the GAO. She has won dozens of journalism awards for economics, financial, and investigative reporting, including 3 Polk Awards, 2 Loeb Awards, and a National Press Club Award. In 2003, she was part of a team at the Wall Street Journal that was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for articles on corporate scandals. Her new book is Retirement Heist: How Companies Plunder and Profit from the Nest Eggs of American Workers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ellen Schultz.
Hi, Ian.
And your book, Retirement Heist, How Companies Plunder and Profit from the Nest Eggs of American Workers. I saw you recently on Jon Stewart's The Daily Show, Ellen, and he had a very similar reaction that I did, which was, you know, you think after all of these corporate scandals from the crash of 2008, not that anybody's actually gone to jail, but that's another matter, that there'd be no outrage left. But somehow or other, you've managed to get me angry again.
Well,
thanks a lot.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Yes, John Stewart said he had to have a glass of wine after he read the book. It made him very angry. You know, there's a parallel here with Occupy Wall Street. Or what they're overlooking is that this is exactly the sort of thing they're getting upset about. You know, they're focusing on the bailout of the banks and the subprime crisis that they caused, but the retirement crisis is very similar. It involves a lot of the same players, that is, large companies, banks, financial service industry. And in this case, it wasn't them decimating the mortgages of Americans. It was them decimating retirement plans so that many pensions are now frozen, people's 401ks are withering, and people are assuming that the companies had nothing to do with it because the companies blame workers. They say, well, they got older and the stock market went down, so we just have no choice but to do this. And in my research, as I had mentioned, that they actually played a big role in causing the crisis by taking billions of dollars out of the pension plans, cutting benefits to sort of make up for that, and using these strategies to boost profits, which, not surprisingly, boosted executive pay and executive pensions. So now companies have large and growing liabilities for the executives, even as what they owe regular people is shrinking.
So this has been a part of the great wealth transfer then. In effect, you can argue that the 2008 crash subsequent to that with the TARP fund and all the other bailouts represent the greatest transfer of private debt into public debt. But what you're uncovering, Ellen Schultz, is that in your book, Retirement Heist, How Companies Plunder and Profit from the Nest Eggs of American Workers, is that the essentially the executives are plundering the workers' pensions so that they can, on top of the massive salaries that they can get, they can retire with hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yes, it's through indirect means. It's not like they just reach in and pull it out. And that's why it's been so hard for people to recognize. You know, you talked about the transfer of debt from the banks to the government and the public. Well, this was similar. It was erasing their debt. They owed $1 trillion to people for pensions and retiree health care, and they used a lot of strategies to get out of owing this. And as you know, pension, just in the simplest form, it's essentially if you work for me today and earn $10, I'll give you $9 now and $1 years from now with essentially interest. So you'll have a part of your pay later. And it's that later part that companies are now saying they can't pay. And what actually fueled this was a change in accounting rules back in the early 90s, which enabled companies to report any kind of debt that they erased as profit. So companies knew that if they just, you know, cut a little here, a little there, whether it's dental plans or retiree health care, spouse coverage, cost of living increase for a pension, anything they did like that was erasing a debt. So they reported that as income. And this coincided with the change in the way executives were being compensated. It used to be, sure, they got big salaries, but companies began to award them pay that was based on performance, i.e. stock performance. So anything that boosted income boosted their pay, which was based on stock options and stock awards. And naturally, as their pay got larger, the pensions that they have, which are separate executive pensions, also ballooned. So it was just sort of a cycle where cutting regular benefits for regular folks sort of fueled the growth of executive pensions and pay.
We're talking about a kind of cultural thing, at least that's what I get from my sort of outrage translates into trying to understand how a small group of Americans see themselves as being incredibly valuable at the expense of the larger 99%. And I'm trying to figure out what justifies this. And clearly we're in a culture now where the CEO compensations have gone up, I think, in the 50s, I think they were 40 times what the lowest paid worker is, and now it's, I think, over 300 times or 400 times. You have these CEOs that go from, you know, a pineapple canning factory to an aerospace company, and without missing a beat, apparently they've got some incredible skill that is worth hundreds of millions of dollars. What you've been on Wall Street for some time, Ellen Schultz, with the Wall Street Journal, you were part of the team that won the Pulitzer Prize for uncovering corporate scandals in 2003. What led you to this? I mean, what? Because I go back to my remark and the one that also that Jon Stewart made on the Daily Show is that, you know, we thought we'd seen it all until you come along and with Retirement Heist, and it sort of crystallizes in many ways the worst of corporate greed.
Well, what started it was just a very simple question, which is I noticed companies were changing their pension plans and announcing it with great, you know, fanfare. And you know, they gave me press releases saying, look, we're changing our plans. It's better for people. And I said, so why are you changing your plans? And they insisted it was just because it was better for people and better for a modern workforce. And I said, well, are you saving money? They insisted they weren't saving a dime. Meanwhile, they were telling their shareholders, or at least IBM in this case, that they were going to save $200 million. And I couldn't understand how they could save $200 million because they had a massive surplus. I mean, most of the large companies had huge surpluses at that time. You know, $24 billion at Verizon, for example. So what's going on? They wouldn't explain why they were cutting benefits, or that they were cutting benefits, even though they had tons of money. And, you know, that's when I finally figured out that there was an accounting gimmick going on that enabled them to boost profits. And once you sort of figure out that almost everything a company does with benefits is to boost profits, then it's just a question of following the track. So, for example, you've seen companies insist on ESOPs. They say ESOPs, which are employee stock ownership plans, oh, these are to help employees feel like they own the company too. You know, they're also owners. It's an ownership society. Well, ESOPs aren't necessarily for that. You know, many of them were set up as leveraged deals that enabled companies to borrow money cheaply, and the downside for employees was that their basically retirement plan was all in the company's stock, which is a really bad idea, especially if you're like Enron and your stock goes to nothing. People lose all their money. Companies also insist that, well, you know, employees and executives share risk. You know, they have company stock, and so they all want the company to do well. Well, they don't share the same risk. Employees can see their plans wiped out, and as I saw after the market cratered in 2008, the executives at least a quarter of the companies had gains in their own personal savings plans, even when everybody else was down 40%. And even at companies that in which the executives had essentially the same funds that the regular employees had to invest in, some of them picked only winning funds out of everything. What are the odds that the executives picked only the winners? I asked the companies that, and they said, well, they're just lucky. So, you know, there is no shared risk. A lot of this is just it's a smokescreen. Employees don't have the same risk level. They have more risk. And another example of that is the company's paying out pensions as lump sums and saying, well, it's good for you because you can manage it yourself. Well, sure, you take the investment risk and interest rate risk and inflation risk. And the other thing that no one thinks about is the longevity risk. You know, when the companies complain that their workers are getting older and so they're going to have to pay more in pensions, well, that's nonsense. They pay out lump sums. They have no exposure to longevity anymore. Once the worker's left with its payout, the company, it doesn't matter. They could live to be 300 years old and it won't affect the company in any way.
Well, as you pointed out, Alan Schultz, in retirement heist, how companies plunder and profit from the nest eggs of American workers, that whereas workers' pensions have all but disappeared and have been eviscerated, the pensions for the executives are huge. I think you cited General Electric sitting on an enormous amount of money. And this practice that you're talking about has gone on with the top Fortune 500 companies. These aren't bottom feeders we're talking about here.
S&P 500 companies. We're talking about the companies that account for about 60 or 70% of all pension dollars in the U.S. And that's another misconception people have. I hear it over and over that, oh, everyone's got rid of their pensions. There aren't any pensions anymore. Well, there are 44 million people in private pension plans. That's, you know, not the post office workers, not the military. All those public plans are separate because there are 44 million at companies, corporations, and that includes retirees and active, about 50-50. So there's a huge number of people affected, and even if people don't have pensions, they ought to pay attention to this. Like, take the 401k. You might think, okay, well, I don't have a pension, so who cares? Well, the same guys that are running these games with the pension plans are running your 401k. And that means that, you know, you might have high fees that are hidden. You might have a lot of company stock in there, which is convenient for the company, but not so much for you. And you may not be aware that, especially if you're younger and lower paid, companies discriminate against lower paid employees in their retirement plans, and they're allowed to do so despite rules that say you cannot discriminate in favor of the executives when you talk about these regular plans. That they can have discriminatory plans for executives, and they all do, separate plans. But when it comes to the rank and file plans, whether it's a 401k or a pension, they're supposed to treat everyone more or less the same. But they have used a lot of loopholes in the discrimination rules that result in discrimination against lower paid employees. So you could have a company that says, oh, we contribute 4% to a 401k. Well, sure, they'll contribute 4% to low paid and 6% to high paid. That's just one example of how this works. Same thing with pensions. You provide a higher percentage to a higher paid person than you do to a lower paid. And this is all legal. It's all a perversion of the discrimination rules.
Well, just in closing, Ellen Schultz, you mentioned how the pensions laws were changed to enable this looting by, you know, through the small print and through clever lawyers, sort of reminiscent of the clever people on Wall Street who suckered all these people into subprime mortgages and ran off with billions. And even on top of that, you had people like Paulson, the hedge fund manager, who was able to bet that the house of cards would all come down. And he made, what, $5 billion by betting against the house. So how much – and we know that getting rid of Glass-Steagall and all the so-called laws that were passed to free up Wall Street entrepreneurs ended up contributing to the crash. In terms of the looting of pensions that you've covered in your book, Retirement Heist, how companies plunder and profit from the nest eggs of American workers, how did the Congress do this then? And this is the same Congress, we should remind ourselves, that's going after Social Security now. And several times in this interview, Ellen, you pointed out that if it wasn't for Social Security, these people would have nothing.
Well, one of the key things they did was when federal pension law was enacted, it didn't have any provision for remedy, which means that there are no damages for pain and suffering or punitive awards of any kind. So you don't have the kinds of things that actually tend to finance large class actions. So companies have learned that there's really little downside to even breaking the law, because the worst that can possibly happen under benefit law, and this means for health care that they provide and pensions and 401ks, the very worst that can happen is that they have to pay the benefit that they were supposed to pay. Now, if the person's dead already, well, then they don't have to pay anything. And so with this in mind, companies can drag out litigation for years, and people die or give up in the meantime, and companies end up ahead.
Well, Ellen, I thank you so much for joining us here today and for allowing us to offer up your new book, Retirement Heist, How Companies Plunder and Profit from the Nest Eggs of American Workers. It's as disturbing it is, it's very compelling, and I think it's very necessary I think people should equip themselves, at least if you believe that you are a part of the 99%. Would you agree?
Yes, very much.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us, Helen.
Thank you, Ian.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. Again, I've been speaking with Ellen Schultz, who's an investigative reporter who has covered the retirement crisis for more than a decade. Formerly with the Wall Street Journal, her reporting led to congressional hearings, proposed legislation, investigations by the Treasury and the GAO. She has won dozens of journalism awards for economics, financial, and investigative reporting, including 3 Polk Awards, 2 Loeb Awards, a National Press Club Award, and in 2003, she was part of a team at the Wall Street Journal who awarded the Pulitzer Prize for articles on corporate scandals. Her new book, Retirement Heist, How Companies Plunder and Profit from the Nest Eggs of American Workers. Thank you so much for joining me. I'd also like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at ianmasters.com, where you can sign up for podcasts and contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another background briefing. Bye for now.